without any decrease in their burdens thereof. So everybody here will be liable for punishment by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For example, one of the evil practices could be that a person on a particular day decided to do something haram, and people will join him in this, right? And then when he passed away, the others who would join him continued this particular tradition of that particular haram act at that particular time, at that particular place. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that one of the best places where this to occur is our own children. That we provide good habitual practices for our own children. That when we go, at least they will be able to continue that tradition, inshaAllah. Until next time, my dear brothers and sisters. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. The Saudi regime-led coalition started its war on the enemy people, in 2014, with the hope of their bombing campaign and onslaught not taking more than a month or two to defeat them. Now, 7 years later, it is the Yemeni forces which have turned the tables and are now retaliating with its latest offensive on Ma'arib, shocking the Saudi regime. Stay with us as we take a look at what it all means on this Spotlight. I'd like to start this off with our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali. Abdul Latif, fill us in on the latest situation of what has taken place.
Yes, thank you so much. The Yemeni army has successfully accomplished the second phase of Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation in Nata and Nu'man regions, were fully liberated from the Saudi-backed terrorist groups in this operation. Almost 390 squared kilometers were liberated. The Yemeni army launched this operation and the first stage of this operation almost 2 weeks ago. The Yemeni army confiscated a huge number of weapons. They are US made, according to military experts, and this is yet another proof of the US military support for the terrorist groups in Yemen, especially in Al Bayda, which is a new front to pressure the Yemeni army to limit its advances toward Ma'arib city. The Minister of Defense today vowed the Saudi-led coalition and vowed all the other forces that they still have many surprises in case the war and the siege are still ongoing against the Yemeni people.
All right, thank you so much, Abdul Latif, for that update. And I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, Brett Yonkers, historian and journalist out of Hausa, and Hossein Al-Bakhati, journalist and political commentator out of Sana'a. I'd like to start it off with Brett, your perspective. What has happened that from the beginning of this war, the Saudis were basically expecting to breeze through it, and now they're on the edge of defeat?
I think this is a pretty typical case of imperial arrogance and imperial overstretch, as it is called, in which a nation that is used to being praised as a modern country, as a powerful power, as a power broker in the region, as one of the most, one of the absolute richest countries in the area, in the Arab world, and in fact one of the richest countries in the world, of course, and of course one with a state-of-the-art modern military, has to, whenever a country like that goes to war, of course they have in their mind the idea that this will be fast, this will be easy, this should be no real issue, really. I often compare it a little to what happened in Vietnam in the 1960s and 1970s, when, of course, the most powerful military in the world, the United States of America, went to war against what they saw as a backward Southeast Asian nation and got defeated, terribly defeated, in fact, by the Vietnamese resistance. And this is something that we have seen now. Of course, this war is still dragging on, and there is still a lot of room for changes in the future. Nobody really knows what the future will hold, of course. But the fact that we are now almost 7 years later and Yemen is still standing strong is by itself already a victory, because, as you mentioned, indeed, the Saudis and the Emiratis and their allies, they went to war in 2015 with the idea of being in Sana'a in a matter of weeks, in fact. And they have not done this. In fact, they have lost almost all control over the actual battlefield. They are sending Sudanese mercenaries. Now, recently, they are sending mercenaries from other East African countries. Mm-hmm. They are sending child soldiers to do the dirty fighting for them. But they are completely incapable of holding on to any real power on the ground. They are incapable of holding on to the central of Yemen, and even nowadays to the south. Even in Aden and Hadramaut, deep in the south of Yemen, which has been occupied for 6 years, they are losing control. And now, of course, when you see that Marib is at the verge of being liberated by the Yemeni forces of the National Salvation Government in Sana'a, and when you see the operation of Nasr al-Mubin now happening in the province of Baida, this is all a massive propaganda failure, of course, for the Saudis. They are being defeated over and over and over again by a people who have nothing except for their tenacity and except for their dedication to their independence and their sovereignty.
All right, well, let me get Hossein in on this conversation. How have Ansarullah and Yemeni forces been able to be successful when there is a land, sea, and air siege on the country that's been implemented by the Saudis and allowed by their Western partners, such as the United States?
First of all, the Saudi blockade and total attacks and strikes have killed maybe 20,000 Yemeni civilians, including many children, and the blockade has killed more than 300,000 Yemenis, most of them children, from severe malnutrition and from other diseases. This actually exposed the Saudi coalition backed by the United States that they actually don't want any peace for Yemen. They don't want Yemen to be free, and as well what they have done in the south. Saudi coalition claimed that the war against Ansarullah the Houthi is, as they say, to tackle down that coup and to bring Hadi legitimacy into Sana'a. But still, we've seen in the south that United Arab Emirates, they have created the so-called Southern Transition Council, which actually does not recognize Hadi government. They see the security situation in the south, how Al-Qaeda is running freely there, how Al-Qaeda is working side by side with Saudi and as well with the United Arab Emirates to fight the Houthi, and as well there are shortages of fuel, no security. I mean, everything there is upside down. That's why Yemenis actually has realized that this war actually is not about legitimacy, is about to bring Hadi to Yemen. Hadi, who is actually a puppet or a tool in the hand of Saudi and United States. And on the other hand, we see in areas under the control of Sana'a forces, there is well-tight security. Al-Qaeda has been eliminated from areas under the control of Sana'a. The only thing that Sana'a and areas under control of Sana'a government is the fuel shortages, food shortages, and this actually is because of the direct blockade. I just want to add that in the last 3 months, since Biden has actually sworn as United States president, we have seen actually one of the largest fuel shortages in Yemen history, not only during the 7 years of Saudi war. And this actually exposed that the United States, especially Biden, they want to use the weapon of blockade more against Yemenis. And one final thing, why Yemenis actually are successful, because Yemeni have actually relied on
military equipment that they have, they actually upgraded their military equipment and they stay resistant to fight Saudi, and they don't want to surrender or to give up towards Saudi coalition.
Well, Brett, I mean, we've heard from various UN agencies about the humanitarian suffering and disaster which is taking place in Yemen due to the siege and bombings, but we haven't seen much action. We've heard a lot of talk. Why is that the case?
Because this war is an extremely profitable business venture for a lot of Western nations, and especially, of course, their arms corporations. The Saudi war machine is oiled and supplied almost completely, of course, by the United States and by the United Kingdom and by France. These are, and in certain ways also by the Zionist entity of Israel, these are billions and billions of dollars that are spent by the Saudi regime every single year since 2015 in trying to keep up the war machine that they have built up. Like I said, it's a state-of-the-art war machine, but the problem is that the Saudis have shown themselves time and time again completely incapable of using this high-tech weaponry. So basically what they're doing is they're sending the best they have in terms of equipment into the battlefield in Yemen, where they lose it almost immediately, to sometimes makeshift weaponry, improvised explosives, or sometimes even due to the fact that the Yemeni forces, they chase away the drivers of the vehicles and then burn them by just using matches and petroleum. So every time this happens, of course, the Saudis are in need of further military purchases. And aside from the obvious economic advantages this brings to these arms corporations in the West, there is the fact that this is it's a sort of propaganda war as well. Saudi Arabia has window dressed this entire conflict as a battle against what they call Iranian proxies, which is objectively untrue, because there is no Iranian influence, nor any Iranian troops have there ever been in Yemen. But this window dressing has been accepted as fact by the Western mainstream media. So if now they were to accept the fact that Saudi Arabia were to retreat or were to lose too easily, this can be constructed, can be perceived as a victory for Iran, which is, of course, a very easy victory for Iran, considering that Iran didn't actually have to do anything in order to win this propaganda victory, because they're not technically involved. But this is another reason, I think, why from an ideological viewpoint for the West, this is very important to keep this war going and to try to get as much as they can out of this conflict.
Mm.
The Saudis themselves, of course, have always had a very strategic objective and very strategic interest in this region. We're talking, of course, Yemen, which borders the Bab al-Mandab Strait, which borders the Red Sea connection that goes eventually to the Suez Canal and that way to the Mediterranean. And, of course, the Arab Sea, which is the gateway into the Indian Ocean, the Indian subcontinent, and further into Asia. We already have seen that in several southern and eastern Yemeni provinces, the ones that have been occupied by Saudi Arabia for going on 7 years now, there are massive oil pipelines that have been constructed already that will lead to port cities in Yemen that are occupied by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. The goal of this is to make sure that Saudi Arabia can export oil, can pump oil from their own deserts and partially also from Yemen, straight onto the Yemeni coast, straight onto the Arabian Sea, and this way they can completely circumvent things like the Red Sea or the Persian Gulf, which, of course, for Saudi Arabia, it saves money, it saves time, and it would be an incredibly profitable, again, business venture that they are going for.
All right.
So for the entire thing, basically, the point is that for the West, it's all about money and about power in the end. They don't care about the humanitarian cost that this actually brings to the field in Yemen itself.
Okay. Well, Hossein, the latest offensive by the Yemeni forces is taking place in Ma'arib. And tell us about Ma'arib and why this particular offensive is so significant.
The latest offensive, as example, that took place in Al-Baida province, central Yemen. Yemeni army has controlled about 400 square kilometers, and those area were under a total control of Al-Qaeda, and it's known that those one of the strongest or safe haven for Al-Qaeda. And when actually who opened that front is the Saudi-backed the Saudi coalition side by side with Al-Qaeda and ISIS, because they want to reduce the pressure on Ma'arib. They thought that Sana'a forces cannot fight in many front at what time, and what actually Yemeni army have shown here in Sana'a, that they are well equipped to attack anywhere, and they are well equipped as well to continue their attack to liberate Marib. And I just want to see, we have seen the amount of outcry from the United States, United Nations, UK, and other countries who support this war against Yemen. They are crying out loud about the liberation of Marib, and as well what happened in Al Bayda. We haven't, because they said of the civilians in Marib, but they totally ignore when Saudi coalition were like maybe 20 kilometers east of Sana'a in Nahum. Nobody has said don't enter Sana'a, which have about 500 million Yemeni civilians. The attack against Hudaydah, we didn't see any condemnation from the United Nations or UN or any other organization. This is actually because the United States want Yemen to stay a hub for Al-Qaeda. They have moved Al-Qaeda from Afghanistan to Iraq, to Syria, to Libya, and now they want to have a safe haven in this area because they have almost lost the war against Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and because Iraqi and Syrians have actually defeated Al-Qaeda, they want to have this hub, which Marib actually now is have many hundreds of fighters from Al-Qaeda and ISIS who are fighting side by side. As well, there are four officials who work with Hadi government who are actually in the so-called treasury list of the United States for supporting Al-Qaeda. One of them is Al-Jouf governor, who have actually fled Al-Jouf when Sana'a Falls has liberated, and as well the brother of the governor of Marib, he is as well in that terrorist list. Hadi so-called advisor Al-Humaykani, he's from Al-Bayda, he's in going in and out from Riyadh, he's on that list. And to show you exactly, United States is only using Al-Qaeda to fight and to create fight against Yemeni civilians like they did before. Okay. And they're using this crying out loud because they don't want Marib to be liberated. And as well, Marib have the oil field and gas field, the only place in Yemen, and Saudi actually is exporting millions of barrels since this war began against Yemen, because they want to support the war from revenue that comes from Yemeni oil. Okay. Because the economy has become really weak since the war started.
What about that, Brecht? I mean, we have seen more of an outcry from various Western entities and television stations or networks in dealing with the situation of Marib, as Hossein said, condemning it and talking about the humanitarian disaster that could take place. I mean, it just seems that more and more they're exposing their hypocrisy. Your assessment of it?
Well, of course, every time when you see Western pundits and Western news outlets report on situations like this, especially, of course, every time they talk about when the quote-unquote Houthis, so the forces of the National Salvation Government in Sana'a, are making progress, then suddenly, of course, the alarm bells are going off all across Europe and the West in general. And in many ways, this is similar to back in the day when the war was going on in Syria around Aleppo, when now as well still nowadays in the region of Idlib. Every time the Syrian Arab army says finally that this is now enough is enough, all peace talks have failed, the rebels, the terrorist forces are still there on Syrian soil, and we want to do something about it. Every time the Syrian army finally moves forward, even after all these years of waiting and negotiating, then suddenly, of course, the alarm bells are going off and there are talks about how terrible the situation is and how horrible the Syrian Arab army is mistreating its own civilians. In some ways, this is similar in Yemen. Of course, it is different because the Yemeni National Salvation Government is not portrayed as a regime in the West, but they are portrayed as being the rebels, which by itself is ridiculous because they rule over the absolute majority of the Yemeni population and are the only of two governments that have any form of popular legitimacy in the eyes of the people themselves. But that's a different discussion, of course. But aside from that, the reporting is similar. Whenever the National Salvation Government advances, like, for example, on Marib, they're saying there are reports in the West coming out and saying, oh, there's famine in Marib, there's problem in Marib, people are dying because of the shelling and because of the bombardments. And unfortunately, obviously, that is true. But what they failed to mention is that people have been starving in Yemen every single day for the past 6 to 7 years because of the Saudi blockade. They are trying, of course, in the West to pin it on different sort of things. They're pinning it on the, they're making this all both sides are bad story, or they're saying, you know, that the Houthis are hogging all the humanitarian aid, the Houthis are destroying the food. They even tried to blame it on the cut, which is that herb that in Yemen that is a popular hunger suppressant. In fact, that people chew in the West, they claim like because they are growing this crop, they are failing to grow enough food for themselves, etc., etc. So the amount, the extent to which this yellow page journalism, this propagandic journalism will go is absolutely unbelievable when you look at it from an objective viewpoint. But unfortunately, that is, of course, the situation we are in right now. And the reason why they're doing this, of course, is they're trying to play the humanitarian angle in order to justify the maintenance of the status quo. They've always been doing this. Every time a rebel or a revolutionary group pops up that fights against imperialism, that fights against tyranny, that fights against terrorism, these revolutionaries will be portrayed as the new terrorists. They will be portrayed as the ones who disturb the peace. Mm-hmm. There is no talk about the fact that Saudi Arabia is starving the country. No, they talk about the fact that the Houthis fail to surrender, that they refuse to give up. This is lies, basically, that are being spread over and over again. They have done it about Iraq, they have done it about Syria, they have done it about Iran, and now they're doing it about Yemen.
Okay.
Unfortunately, even when they talk about, you know, we should do something about the humanitarian situation, and when they do admit that Saudi Arabia is at fault, they immediately spin it into a both sides are bad story, and their solution will always be, oh, maybe we should negotiate some more, let's host another conference in Geneva or wherever, in order to talk this out, without, of course, addressing the root
All right, stay with me, Brett.
Which is the invasion.
Stay with me, please. Just a few minutes left. I got to get Hossein back in this. Hossein, how likely is it that the Yemeni forces will get total control of Ma'arab? And what would that mean? Would we be seeing the beginning of the end of this terrible war, or your assessment?
I think if Sana'a forces liberated Ma'arab, I think that the Saudi will not actually stop its war. And I believe that the United States, after that, will actually be directly involved in the war of Yemen. I expected they could send hundreds of troops to areas that's under the Saudi-led coalition control, because they know Ma'arab and the control of Ma'arab means that Sana'a forces are well equipped to actually to liberate all Yemen, and the United States and Saudi doesn't want that. That's why I believe that if Yemeni forces will continue their attack, they shouldn't stop, and as well they should actually keep targeting Saudi Arabia, because in the last few months there were less attack against Saudi Arabia, and now given the Saudi and United States time, they could use they could enforce more blockade against Yemen. They have actually printed Yemeni riyals like in the last 7 years, more than what has been printed in the last 25 years. They show you that they want to now to target Yemen by their economy. The exchange rate for dollar here in Sana'a is half now what is actually in Aden, and they show you that here actually they are well equipped to fight the war, either economy by the economy or to fight politically, and as well the main attack against Saudi Arabia, I think it will stop this war. But if we continue just to liberate areas in Yemen without targeting Saudi Arabia, targeting their economy, this means that we're giving Saudi time to enforce more types of blockade against Yemen.
All right, Hossein. Well, Brett, 1 minute. You think the retaliation must continue? And as Hossein, though, he talked about not only retaliation and defending inside of Yemen, but also offensive inside of Saudi Arabia. Your take, 1 minute.
Yeah, and if I indeed to say it in a short way, I think the Yemenis are definitely within the right to keep attacking, keep counterattacking, and take back the rest of their country. And in fact, I believe Saudi Arabia should be very, very grateful if they can get out of this war by only having to pull back out of all of the Republic of Yemen. They should be very grateful if they can get to keep Jaizan, Najran, and Asir, because these are regions of Greater Yemen that were stolen by the Saudis in 1934. But if they can to keep this, and if they, if the Yemenis allow the Saudis to keep this part of Saudi Arabia and the and do not reclaim it back for Yemen, the Saudis should be very, very fortunate, because that's the best possible outcome for them that they can still have in this form.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us here on the Spotlight. Brett Yonkers, historian and journalist out of House of Saud, and Hossein al-Bahati, journalist and political commentator out of Sana'a. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Thanks so much, and goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَلَا نُكَلِّفُ نَفْسًا إِلَّا وُسْعَهَا وَلَدَيْنَا كِتَابٌ يَنطِقُ بِالْحَقِّ وَهُمْ لَا يُظْلَمُونَ.
And we charge no soul except with that within its capacity. And with us is a record which speaks with truth, and they will not be wronged.
Brothers and sisters, as you have been previously with us, we were talking about the 62nd verse of the chapter. وَلَا نُكَلِّفُ نَفْسًا إِلَّا وُسْعَهَا وَلَدَيْنَا كِتَابٌ يَنْطِقُ بِالْحَقِّ وَهُمْ لَا يُغْلَمُونَ. And we do not task a soul but to the extent of its ability, and with us is record which clearly speaks the truth, and they will not be dealt with unjustly. Regarding this verse, we said that based on this verse, there is a rule based on the Islamic jurisprudence called the negation of distress and constriction. And this rule governs all Islamic rulings, and it has priority over them all. As you may remember, in the previous program, we said that one probability of the meaning of the word record, لَدَيْنَا كِتَاب, is that it's a book that somehow holds all the man's deeds, and they are all recorded in that. So they have to stand before Allah based on this record. And it means that this record can speak and tell the truth in such a way that it is not possible for the people to deny it. Another probability, though, is that this record is the protected tablet, or that Lawh al-Mahfuz. Moreover, the Quranic verse Ladaina, which says with us is this record, confirms this interpretation. So it seems that this meaning is closer to the reality. The verse, however, indicates the fact that every single deed of ours will be accurately recorded and none of them will be forgotten. Belief in this fact encourages the righteous to do good deeds and dissuades them from doing wrong. This verse is completely in accordance with the previous verses talking about the characteristics of the believers, that they completely believe in resurrection and they know they have to stand before their Lord. And at the same time they're standing before their Lord, they will not be dealt with unjustly. وَهُمْ لَا يُظْلَمُونَ. And this might be referring to the fact that there will be no injustice when people are punished or rewarded for their deeds. They are recorded accurately and no one will be dealt with unjustly.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
in this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insight into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
There is one point remaining regarding the previous phrase which says, لَدَيْنَا كِتَابٌ يَنْتِقُ بِالْحَقِّ. This speaking the truth, which is one of the characteristics of this record, shows that this record of man's deeds is so plain and convincing that it does not need to be explained. As we have said before, it is as if the record itself would speak and reiterate the truth without the necessity of reading it. So that could be one of the meanings of speaking the truth. So it is so plain, it is so convincing, it does not need to be explained. And one interesting fact, dear listeners, that can be understood from this verse is that this verse is somehow mentioning the different points to be observed in management. One of the principles in management is to keep the people busy doing their responsibilities and at the same time giving them enough incentives to do so. At the end of the verse it says, وَهُمْ لَا يُظْلَمُونَ. They will be treated with justly, be it in their punishment or their promotions. They will be dealt with justly. The second rule regarding management is that everyone's responsibility should not be the same. Everyone has different capabilities, and based on these capabilities, the responsibilities must be distributed among them. And the last point that can be inferred from this verse is that they need complete and constant monitoring. وَلَدَيْنَا كِتَابٌ يَنْطِقُ بِالْحَقِّ. With us, there is a record which clearly speaks the truth. So we always need this kind of monitoring and supervising. Wherever we're working and whoever we're working with, we need this constant monitoring. We are done with the 62nd verse, dear listeners. Thank you for staying with us. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Around the world with reporters.
We are all against the health pass. That was the main slogan that brought together many protesters all over France. For the third week in a row, they continued marching against the government's decision to put in place a health pass for all citizens. This is an electronic document that every citizen has to show in public places that proves that they are vaccinated or have a negative PCR test. Medical figures are crystal clear. In European countries where the majority of its population is vaccinated, like the UK, the Netherlands, Denmark or Ireland, the COVID virus and its Delta variant are under control. So why are these protesters taking the street again?
I am in favor of the vaccination. Not for this one, because we have not enough information about this vaccine. So I am in favor of the vaccination, but I am against the health path. We have our liberties and no one should tell us what we should do or not.
In hospitals, doctors say that the new wave of people with severe COVID symptoms are all non-vaccinated persons. In Martinique and La Réunion, two overseas French territories, a new lockdown has begun, given that very few people are vaccinated. The vaccination campaign has accelerated the last 3 weeks. In France now, More than 50% have received two jabs of the vaccine. So is it responsible to protest against these mandatory measures?
All this science will tell us that science needs time to be proven efficient. So we need more time to see what's really happening.
I am not against the vaccine itself. I am more against the health pass and the political use of it. If the government had given sufficient means to health workers and hospitals to handle the COVID crisis, it would have been more efficient.
3,000 police officers have been mobilized to control all the marches today in the French capital. There were some clashes. It's amazing to see so many protesters on the street at the start of the holiday season. Some say that with these protests against the authoritarian measures of the French government, the Yellow Vest movement rose from its ashes. Despite clear indications that vaccination is effective in reducing symptomatic cases and deaths from COVID-19, protests continue in France, but rather against a mandatory health pass considered as a violation of individual liberties rather than against the vaccination itself. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
A new victory against the Saudi-backed militant groups was made by Yemen's armed forces in the second phase of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation. The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, said Nu'man and Nata' regions of the country's central province of Al-Bayda were fully liberated from the control of the Saudi-backed terrorists. He said the military operation had left hundreds of Saudi-backed militants killed and injured, adding that the Yemeni forces had also captured a number of the militants.
Our armed forces have completed the second phase of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation, which led to the liberation of the districts of Nate'e and Nu'man and the defeat of the elements of the militant groups associated with the Saudi-led coalition and inflicting heavy losses on them, while hundreds of them were killed, wounded, and captured.
Sariya also said the Yemeni forces have confiscated militants' weapons, which are U.S.-made, according to military experts. They say this is yet another proof of the U.S. military support for Daesh and Al-Qaeda terrorists in Yemen.
This operation proved that the United States supports terrorist groups, whether militarily or through statements accusing the Yemeni army of hampering the peaceful solutions. America is the one who directs and controls the terrorist groups. Today, there is a lot of evidence proving Washington's support for terrorist groups, including American-made weapons that the Yemeni army seized during the recent operation.
2 weeks ago, the Yemeni army took control of large areas in Al-Bayda, the first stage of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation that was launched on July 13th. The operation was part of military efforts to push members of Al-Qaeda and Daesh out of their strongholds in Al-Bayda.
Observers say the U.S. support for the terrorist groups in Al-Bayda is aimed at hampering the Yemeni army's advances toward Marib, the last stronghold of Saudi-backed militants in northern Yemen. However, the Yemeni army says it will continue the operations until the liberation of all Yemeni territories and putting an end to years-long Saudi-imposed war. Abdullatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
There is no evidence of institutional racism in the UK, says a report commissioned by the British government. But a landmark art exhibition on the doorsteps of Queen Elizabeth II paints a very different picture.
War in the Babylon is the title of this exhibition about black communities and their long struggle against systemic racism here in the UK. It comes 10 years after the police killing of unarmed black man Mark Duggan on the streets of London, with the aim of shining a light on his family's struggle for justice, as well as many more families who have lost a loved one at the hands of the British state.
Since 1990, there have been 1,433 people who have died in police custody. While the majority of deaths are white British, there is a disproportionate overrepresentation of black people who die as a result of use of force or restraint by the police.
10 years since the killing of Mark Duggan, but in 2015, in Haringey, the same borough, they killed Jermaine Baker. Last week, we had a notice put out that another person of colour, black person, has been killed in Haringey by the same police.
Stafford Scott, the curator of the exhibition, and who supported many of these families in their fight for justice, designed the showcase to illustrate how systemic racism is not just present in the police force, but something that permeates through different institutions in British society.
The War in Babylon is an exhibition that we hope encapsulates the entirety of the black experience in the UK. You'd have recently heard this foolishness from some report by some geezer called Tony Sewell that said that there's no such thing as institutional racism in this country. War in Babylon says that that's an absolute lie and provides the absolute evidence that that is a lie.
The pictures, videos and texts present an account for those whose voices are often not heard, or worse still, willfully ignored by the mainstream.
We're at the Mall. That's the same address as the Queen of England, the Queen of England resides. We've moved the front line in the fight against racism and the fight for truths and rights from off of the estates, from out of the hood, and we've taken it right to the heart of the establishment.
The need for exhibitions like this is as pertinent now as it's ever been, especially as the British government expands policies like racially disproportionate blanket stop and search, while simultaneously denying the existence of institutional racism, signalling to black communities in the UK that their historic fight for equality is far from over. Ahmed Cabello, London.
Palestinians accused Israel of using unjustified deadly force against Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank. In its latest report, Defense for Children International Palestine stated that the Israeli soldiers continue to kill Palestinian children with no recourse or accountability. In its report, DCI Palestine revealed that evidence it has obtained shows children killed didn't pose any threat to the Israeli soldiers at the time of their killing. The group says that Israeli forces used lethal force against Palestinian children in circumstances that may amount to extrajudicial or willful killing.
Killing unarmed minors amounts to war crime and even crime against humanity. Israeli soldiers act in line with shoot-to-kill policy, opening fire to kill Palestinian children. The troopers know their military establishment will hold any of them accountable for killing innocent Palestinians.
On Friday, a 17-year-old Palestinian boy, Mohammed Tamimi, was fatally shot by live ammunition in his back during a peaceful anti-settlement protest that was held in Nabi Saleh town, West Ramallah. Meanwhile, on Monday, a 17-year-old Yusuf Nawaf Mhareb, a resident of the Ramallah area village of Abwin, succumbed to wounds he had sustained a prayer when he was shot in the neck by Israeli forces during a protest against Israel's aggression on the Gaza Strip. Experts say that under international law, the use of lethal force during a protest is allowed only when a direct and lethal threat to life or of serious injury exists. And as usual, Israel continues violating international law, including rules which limit the intentional lethal use of firearms, in particular against children.
Israeli forces have a twofold purpose by targeting Palestinian children. First, they want to intimidate Palestinian children to prevent them from taking part in anti-Israeli activity. And second, to oppress the Palestinians in general, to impose and strengthen the Israeli military control.
Since the beginning of the year, 10 Palestinian minors were killed in the occupied West Bank by Israeli forces using live ammunition. Palestinians accuse Israel of using unjustified force against their children. They even warned that Israeli soldiers will continue killing children in cold blood as long as they won't face inquiry. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Speaker of Iran's parliament, Mohammad Baqir Qalibov, has met Syria's President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Assad said that Iran is a main partner for Syria, which offered its support in all sectors. He asserted that ongoing coordination for fighting terror had a positive impact on the ground and will continue until the liberation of all Syrian territories. Qalibov said the Syrian and Iranian people's determination to participate in the recent presidential elections in the two countries proves the failure of policies of pressure adopted by their enemies. Qalibov held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart, Hamoud Sabbagh. He said military and political relations with Syria are currently in their strongest and best form, expressing willingness to enhance economic cooperation with Syria.
After their failure in military war against Iran, the Zionist and U.S. regimes have waged an economic war against us. Our joint priority now is to achieve development in our countries, improve our economy, restore the infrastructure, and increase the bulk of mutual trade exchange.
Sabbag referred to the high level of coordination between parliaments of Iran and Syria, affirming that the two countries stand together in the resistance alliance, working to eliminate hegemony and colonialism which their enemies are imposing on the region.
We held a very special and important meeting for further coordination between both parliaments through consultations and the exchange of expertise. We also agreed on activating the work of our friendship committees in the two parliaments for the benefit of the two peoples.
Speaker Qalibov also held talks with Syria's Prime Minister Hussein Arnous. They underlined the importance of expansion of economic cooperation in both public and private sectors for facing economic sanctions, as well as the siege imposed on the Iranian and Syrian people. The exchange of visits between Iranian and Syrian officials reflects the strong historic ties between the two countries. There has been a noticeable development in economic, political, military, and parliamentary cooperation since the start of the war on Syria, which represents an alliance both states are strengthening to counter U.S. and Western pressure against them. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and his wife.
Addressing the press, a member of Zazaki's defense team said the Kaduna State High Court discharged and acquitted Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat of all 8 charges in a ruling that lasted for several hours. The judge ruled that the prosecution has failed to establish any case against the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and his wife.
The court ruled that the charge ought not to be in the first place. You cannot arraign a man for an offense that was allegedly committed, as at the time the said crime was not an offense. And the court was very emphatic in that yes, the Kaduna State government has powers to enact laws, but it cannot enact laws to prosecute an offense retrospectively.
Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat were arrested in December 2015 following an attack on his home and worship center by soldiers of the Nigerian army, which resulted in the killing of hundreds of Zazaki's supporters. In a statement, the Islamic movement said the judgment is a vindication of Sheikh Zazaki and a victory for truth and justice against tyranny and oppression.
The events of December 12th and 15th of 2015 were orchestrated by state machinaries who are using the instrumentalities of state apparatus to fight a religious fight. It is strictly, the events of December 12, 2015, is strictly a fight between Shiites and Sunnis, fights that was imported from Saudi Arabia for whatever purpose.
The Kaduna State High Court has set Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat free. The Islamic movement, and indeed many of Zazaki's supporters, have expressed happiness with the outcome of this judgment. Anjum Abdullahi, Kaduna.
Of Ethiopian refugees crossed the Sudanese borders on Monday, arriving at Taya village at Basunda locality in Gadarif state. Reports say the refugees is considered the biggest number of refugees to cross into the country in only one day since the outbreak of war last November in Tigray region. Many believe that the wave may worsen security and humanitarian situation in the region due to armed conflicts erupting at western area of Ethiopia.
Sudan has adopted an open-door policy in receiving Ethiopian refugees since the beginning of the conflict. So far, Sudan has welcomed about 75,000 to 80,000 refugees. We call on the international community to help us meet the needs of the increasing refugees fleeing from the fight in the Tigray region.
Since the beginning of fighting, tens of thousands of Ethiopians have sought safety in Sudan. But conditions in Sudan refugee camps are presenting new challenges, as Sudanese NGOs early responded to humanitarian situation in the state affected of refugees influx.
Actually, since the crisis of the refugees started, the Tigray crisis started, Sudanese representation has been present from day one. And that is basically because we do have our ongoing activities in the region through our branches in Kassala and Gadarif. So we do have ongoing programs for the already existed old refugees in the area. So with the beginning of the crisis, we were already on the ground.
In the light of the latest development in the Tigray region, UN agencies strive to maintain a strong staff presence, provided there is access in Hamadayet in case there is an increased influx. Several partners continue to remain on the ground in anticipation of this possibility.
Security and health challenges face Sudanese and Ethiopian governments to cope with increasing number of refugees. Khartoum says it is still waiting for international support to tackle the crisis. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
An Algerian judoka athlete who made headlines last week for shunning an Israeli opponent at the Tokyo Olympics has now been temporarily suspended along with his coach from the International Judo Federation, meaning that Fethi Nurin will not be able to compete after making his bold statement in support of Palestine. After returning to Algeria, we secured an exclusive interview with Nurin to ask why he felt he had to walk.
I was pitted to play against an athlete from the usurper entity occupying Palestinian land, a regime which kills innocent people and drives them out of their homes, day and night. Because of this, I don't accept that my hand is smeared with someone who represents an entity like this, and for his flag to be associated with the Algerian flag, which is in support of the Palestinians' cause.
His actions meant he would miss out on a chance to win a medal, but Nurin admitted he had no regrets.
If the same situation arises, I would not hesitate to take the same decision. The world needs to know that Israel is an occupier and they practice all kinds of laws that deviate from the international laws and human rights. We need to send a message to the world that we deal with all religions with dignity, just as the Islamic religion recommended us to do. Except for the ones who fight against the religion and the Muslims. We are against them and it's our rights to respond to them. We have the right to defend our religion and all oppressed Muslims.
The Olympic Charter takes a strong stance against any political acts, stating that no kind of demonstration or political, religious or racial propaganda is permitted.
However, this isn't the first time that a Muslim athlete has protested against this controversial lineup. Many are now starting to ask questions about the Olympics and their lack of sensitivity on the subject. Also, are the games being used to whitewash Israel at a time when Palestinians remain deeply oppressed? Robert Carter, London.
More and more people in the EU are congregating indoors. The highly contagious Delta variant of COVID-19 is spreading like wildfire in countries like France and Spain. More people are also travelling within the EU. Citizens in Brussels have been sharing their thoughts on the Delta variant.
I don't know where the cases come from, if it's a coffee restaurant or just meeting in our house.
When I see how people are behaving sometimes, I'm not surprised.
The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, says economic confidence is being undermined.
The pandemic continues to cast a shadow, especially as the Delta variant constitutes a growing source of uncertainty.
On Monday, EU finance ministers rubber-stamped COVID-19 recovery funding for four additional nations in the 27-country bloc.
Croatia, Cyprus, Lithuania and Slovenia. Now more than half of national plans is adopted.
However, critics say the billions of euro being administered to national governments will result in citizens being saddled with decades more austerity because there is too much emphasis on loans rather than grants. According to analysts, EU leaders are harming the bloc's economy through their foreign policy. Sanctions are inhibiting trade. Economists say the Iranian market represents a big opportunity. It can be availed of if current efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal succeed. We have been speaking to the head of the European Parliament's Iran delegation about the subject via Skype. She believes the agreement will be reinstated soon.
Many people in Iran say, again and again and again. We
We have not a good partner on this side. This is one of the impacts of this horrible, stupid policy of Trump.
The International Labour Organization, ILO, warns an additional 25 million jobs could be lost globally before the end of this year due to the coronavirus. However, the ILO says if we see an internationally coordinated policy response, the number of people losing their jobs could be much lower. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.